We will handle it today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump says we will handle it after another North Korean missile launch. Question is, will he handle it with any degree of diplomacy?
This is like negotiating with a boss for a raise. You know, you don't walk in and tell that boss, if you don't give me a raise, I'm going to quit. Because what if that boss calls your bluff?
Plus, Rex Tillerson says he's making the State Department more efficient. Experienced diplomats don't buy it.
What the Trump administration is trying to do is eviscerate the State Department, dismantle the Foreign Service.
Plus, South Korea cracks down on bribes in any form, even giving a teacher a flower, for example.
If a teacher accepted that flower, it would be illegal under the law.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us today. When the headlines make you run screaming for the exits, we're here to put things in perspective. That's why we start today with North Korea after their latest provocative missile test and after President Trump's vow that the situation will be handled.
You can't even imagine war with North Korea and the potential catastrophe that would ensue in the loss of human life without having tried diplomacy. And so it really, I think, is in our interest to sit down to see if there's a way forward where we can ratchet down the possibility of war.
Former diplomat Nick Burns there. We'll hear more from him in a moment. First, though, to Lacey Healy, editor of the foreign policy magazine Inkstick and host of the podcast Things That Go Boom, which launches in the new year. She says the White House has employed a high-risk strategy.
This is like negotiating with a boss for a raise. You know, you don't walk in and tell that boss, if you don't give me a raise, I'm going to quit. Because what if that boss calls your bluff? In this situation, President Trump has set a very firm red line. He said, we'll rain fire and fury down. We won't let this happen. Well, it's happening, and it's happening much like many previous potential nuclear weapon states have pursued it as well. They don't go running right over that red line. They don't topple it. They walk very slowly up to it. North Korea is, they're taking small steps. They're walking slowly up to it and seeing if we'll back up our threats.
I guess it is like asking your boss for a raise, except the stakes are just existentially higher. Some North Korea watchers believe this latest intercontinental ballistic missile could reach Washington and the U.S. Eastern Seaboard. What do you think?
We don't know for sure. We don't know all the details of the warhead that was on this missile, but it has traveled quite a lot farther, and the distance that it traveled would allow North Korea to reach Washington, D.C., to reach essentially any target in the continental U.S. that they would like.
It is hard to tell what's hype and what's real in this whole story, but it sounds as though some voices in the foreign policy establishment are suggesting the only options are to attack North Korea now or attack them later. Is that spin, do you think, or are calls for what some people would describe as a preemptive strike actually growing louder?
I think that in many ways those calls are growing louder. The Trump administration is really trying to kind of be the bully on the playground, and North Korea is calling their bluff. And so we're at this point where the option is launch an attack, which is very likely to lead to many deaths in South Korea. It could also lead to many deaths in the United States if North Korea actually does launch a weapon. And we certainly can't rely on our own missile defenses, which have not been proven to be reliable enough to take that kind of risk. Or we have a situation where we sit down and talk. And that's something that the Trump administration hasn't tried yet.
So the saber-rattling gambit that the White House is taking, you think it's purposeful, or is Trump just doing his bluster business as usual on Twitter and in public on an open mic?
From what I've heard from the Trump administration, and certainly not the president himself, but his advisors on this issue, this is a purposeful move. It is, many experts feel, a misguided, purposeful move, but their belief is that if our threat is big enough, and this is something that is certainly something that we've done in the United States before, if the threat is big enough, then we may be able to deter North Korea. Now, that's a pretty big risk that we're taking, though, if they call our bluff.
So, as we already said, Lacey, nuclear war just seems unimaginable with North Korea, with any country. Just broaching the topic makes many people feel so helpless. What do you say to those people?
the idea that Americans often feel like foreign policy is just much too far away to take it on in the way that they have other issues. Climate change, the opioid epidemic, these are things that we feel like we can have some agency in, even if we can't just reach out and change them easily. That's what we have to do with this. We have to buckle down. We have to understand it better. In many ways, our misunderstanding of North Korea as a backward state that could never present a threat to the United States has gotten us here. North Korea has slowly been developing this new nuclear program over many years, and we never really took it seriously. But here we are now, and we have to.
That was Lacey Healy, the editor of the foreign policy magazine Inkstick. So what about talks between President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un? Sounds crazy, but so did the notion of Nixon going to China during the Cold War. Isaac Stonefish is a fellow at the Asia Society. He, for one, says a summit in Pyongyang could be the best way to move forward.
I think what it would do is take away the biggest problem between the United States and North Korea, and that's lack of trust. There are plenty of countries that have the ability to hit the United States with ICBMs, dozens probably, and there are plenty of those that also have the ability to hit the United States with a nuclear weapon if they so choose. Russia, China are very good examples. And the problem is not the technology these countries possess. The problem is the will that they do or don't have to strike the United States. So I think too much of the debate is focusing on North Korea's weapons capability as opposed to the way to get them to not see the United States as an existential threat.
And as you kind of map out this argument for a summit, you draw comparisons between the relationship between the U.S. and North Korea now and the relationship between the U.S. and China during the Cold War. President Nixon made that famous visit to China and sat down with Mao Zedong in 1971. Remind us why that was so unexpected and what that did.
Nixon had created his entire reputation, really, in foreign policy about being tough on communism. And Nixon was able to pen this stunning reversal in part because he had such cover as anti-communist. So I think similarly, Trump, who's been so aggressively anti-North Korea, would also have cover to do this. That said, Trump is no Nixon, North Korea is no China, and yet still there are useful parallels to draw.
So how did Nixon's summit with Mao actually change America's relationship with China? And more to the point, did it increase trust?
It did increase trust. It showed the Chinese side that the Americans were respectful enough about them and their right to exist as a sovereign state that their president would go walk around the Forbidden City and visit the Great Wall and see China as a country that deserved to be embraced. Similarly, I think if Trump went to Pyongyang, or that would show the North Koreans that the Americans weren't fighting for regime change.
How would these two sides overcome the harsh feelings to even get to a summit? I mean, the fiery rhetoric, little rocket man, mentally deranged U.S. dotard, they can't just sit down and say, hey, I was just kidding, right?
I think the silver lining to the absurd and crazy things that Trump says is that we really get the impression that he doesn't believe them. He is very comfortable insulting someone one day and meeting with them the next day. It's harder to know about Kim Jong-un. We know so little about how his mind works, but the North Koreans are surprisingly pragmatic. And one could certainly see a scenario where Kim says to himself, hey, listen, for regime survival, I'm going to swallow a little bit of my pride and meet with this person.
No doubt that detente between the U.S. and North Korea would be good for the two countries and for the rest of the world. But are there any incentives for Trump and Kim Jong-un personally?
Trump likes to portray himself as the ultimate dealmaker. And this would be a really impressive deal to make. You could really see him relishing in being able to say, hey, listen, I solved North Korea. Other presidents couldn't do that, but I did it. For Kim, if Trump went to Pyongyang, one could imagine that he would portray the summit as an American leader coming to their capital, kowtowing to their dear leader. So there could be a lot of good domestic propaganda for Kim Jong-un by bringing Trump in and making him appear subservient to him in state media.
Isaac Stonefish is a reporter and a fellow at the Asia Society. Always good to speak with you, Isaac. Thanks.
Great to chat, Marco.
To make diplomacy effective, you need, obviously, diplomats. And members of the foreign policy community are worried by how the Trump administration is running the State Department. Nicholas Burns co-authored an opinion piece in the New York Times entitled Dismantling the Foreign Service. Burns was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs under George W. Bush. He now teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Ambassador Burns, it does seem that the administration and many of its supporters believe it is prudent to pare back a bloated bureaucracy, the one specifically the State Department I'd like to talk about. I'm guessing you don't agree with that.
I don't. I was a career Foreign Service officer, as was Ryan Crocker, my co-author on this New York Times piece. Every government agency, of course, is in need of reform. No one would object to cost savings and looking at better ways of doing things. That's par for the course. But what the Trump administration is trying to do is eviscerate the State Department, dismantle the Foreign Service. They're proposing a 31% budget cut. They have a hiring freeze. They want to reduce the size of our already small diplomatic officer corps. It's 8,000 officers now. They want to reduce it by 8%. They've not even filled the majority of a leadership post, the great majority in Washington, our ambassadorships overseas. So, for instance, there's no American ambassador in Seoul, South Korea, in the middle of this North Korea crisis. There's no assistant secretary of state for East Asia. And as a result, there's an exodus of officers who are leaving, Foreign Service officers, highly trained, leaving the State Department out of frustration that they're not being listened to. They're not being appointed to senior positions by this very ideological administration, the Trump administration. And I think the saddest thing of all, we write in our piece that there's been a 33% reduction in the number of young Americans applying to take the Foreign Service officer test just in the last 12 months. And for, you know, for someone who I teach at the Kennedy School, we're trying to encourage our students to go into public service. That's disappointing.
Tillerson just this week said from his perspective, everything is fine. So what do you think that suggests about how he envisions the future of the State Department?
Well, what he said yesterday is that we can afford to reduce the number of diplomats by 8% because he said they're going to resolve so many world crises, they're not going to need these diplomats. Frankly, that justice, it doesn't stand up. I mean, even if we resolve the North Korea crisis and Putin was not a threat to the United States and Iraq and Syria were miraculously resolved, there are a thousand other things that the United States needs to do in the world to protect our citizens and advance our interests. So I don't think Secretary Tillerson has made a convincing argument that by weakening the State Department, reducing the number of diplomats, we're going to be stronger. I don't think anyone agrees with him.
What is the goal of that? What is the motivation to say that we need to get to the point where we don't need diplomacy? We don't need a State Department.
I think the goal here, Marco, is the Trump administration wants to radically reduce the budget of certain government agencies, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Interior Department, the State Department. They're willing to put more money into defense. I think I support them in that. They're willing to put more money into Veterans Affairs, and I certainly support them in that too. The idea that somehow the State Department is tertiary, it's not really that important. I think most knowledgeable observers would say that the State Department is involved across the board in more issues for the United States than any other government agency. We need a strong diplomacy. We can't always fight our way through problems. And I think the military would be the first to tell you that.
One last thing, Nick, because from the point of view of ordinary Americans going about their daily business, they probably don't feel impacted by all of this. Why should they care?
Oh, I think, you know, in the 21st century, all of us have to care about what happens in the rest of the world because it has a direct impact on us. Our economy is very much tied into the global economy. And so if we're not successful internationally in stabilizing the economy, it's going to affect jobs here at home. Certainly climate change affects 320 million Americans, all of us. Cybercrime, people hacking into our cell phones and laptops and trying to steal our banking information and our health information. Everyone's affected by this. State Department's on the front lines trying to do something about this, trying to defend America from these problems. I know it's not fully transparent. We can do a better job of talking about it, but I do think Americans, if they kind of reflect on what's important to them, living in a peaceful world, living in a healthy environment, mitigating climate change, defending ourselves from drug traffickers, states on the front lines. So we need those diplomats to help defend us.
Ambassador Nicholas Burns teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco, as always. Thank you.
Up next on the show, when is a flower a bribe? We hear about a corruption crackdown in South Korea. You're with The World. Marco Werman here with The World. Giving a gift is supposed to be a simple thing, but these days in South Korea, giving a gift can get you in trouble. The country adopted a law last year that draws a firm line between a gift and a bribe. It's aimed at wiping out the kind of corruption that got Korea's last president impeached. Now, some business owners say the law has gone too far. Jason Strother has that story from Seoul.
I met Stella during her coffee break. She's from Europe and originally came to South Korea to do a PhD on a government scholarship. But Stella says her degree came with some unofficial costs. She was expected to hand over envelopes filled with cash to her advisors every time they met. Stella is not her real name. She works for that same university now, so she asked that I use a pseudonym and also that I have someone else read what she told me about what happened when she confronted one of her professors. This isn't her voice.
I was explicitly told by one of the members of my committee that I should pay this money because this was Korean custom and I should take this as normal.
Stella says this custom cost her about $900 over a six-month period. Her advisors graciously accepted her gifts and she got her degree. South Korea has a tradition of gift-giving that some people take advantage of. That's according to Joongi Kim, a law professor at Seoul's Yonsei University.
The key issue is when it spills over to gift-giving or the burden to give a gift when there is an authority relationship.
Kim says this kind of corrupt gift-giving is now on the decline thanks to the anti-graft law. It's meant to keep educators, journalists, and public officials on the straight and narrow. It places restrictions on the monetary value of presents that they can both give and receive. Violations are a criminal offense. But Kim says that in some cases, this expansive law seems too strict.
If a elementary school student gives a flower to a teacher that they like, if a teacher accepted that flower, it would be illegal under the law.
And the law is now hurting florists. Miss Yang, who only wanted to give her surname, owns a flower shop in downtown Seoul and says many of her customers were civil servants. Since the law came into effect a year ago, she says orders have plunged, especially for large bouquets that are given as gifts at weddings and funerals. They cost around $300. Yang says she's had to stop hiring part-timers.
I'm desperate. I've been running my shop for 10 years, and I'm seeing other florists who have been in this part of town for 20 or 30 years close because of the law. I know it's good for our society, but it's killing small businesses. Giving gifts like flowers, it's just a way Koreans show how much they care.
Aside from flower shops, tokens of appreciation are picked up at supermarkets, too. Hong Yolp, who heads the Hanu, or Korean Beef Association, says the anti-graft law is also hurting his industry.
Hanu는 대한민국에서 두 개의 명절이 있어요. 설 추석이 있는데.
Huang says that gift sets of Korean beef are traditionally given during the Lunar New Year and the Chuseok Thanksgiving holiday. He says it's a special gift because it's expensive and has a unique taste. But the law puts limits on gifts like this at about $50. You can't get Hanu that cheap. Yuhan Baum is with Transparency International Korea, and he supports the anti-graft law. But he admits that it is affecting some industries. Still, he says the price for flower bouquets and gift packs of Korean beef were artificially high to begin with, in part because government officials weren't using their own money to buy them.
A lot of taxpayers' money was spent on things like flowers and Korean beef. It was substantial, so it needed to be stopped. Yes, this is going to cause some pain for small businesses at first, but in the long run, they will find ways to meet normal consumer demand.
Then he tells me that the anti-graft law won't kill Korea's tradition of gift-giving. On my way out of his office, Yu hands me a small gift-wrap box. I remind him that as a reporter in Korea, I can't accept gifts over $50. He says it's just a tube of toothpaste. I'll be all right. For the World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
Last week, we reported big news out of a UN war crimes court in the Netherlands. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia sentenced Ratko Mladic to life in prison. He was a Bosnian Serb commander who oversaw the genocide of Muslim men and boys in the town of Srebrenica in 1995. His conviction was huge news, but the Mladic case was just one of many before the court. And today, an extraordinary moment in The Hague, just crazy, in fact. The judges were busy ruling on the appeals of six other defendants who were earlier also found guilty of war crimes in Bosnia during the war there in the 90s. One of them was the former Bosnian Croat general Slobodan Praljak. He is now dead, apparently from swallowing poison while he was in the dock today. My BBC colleague Anna Holligan is in The Hague and describes what happened.
The appeals had been proceeding smoothly. The judge had already upheld the original sentences given to the first two appellants. When it came to that of Slobodan Praljak, he stood up to hear whether his original sentence of 20 years would be amended.
Concerning Praljak, in all other respects, affirms the sentence of 20 years of imprisonment.
But instead of accepting the ruling, Praljak stayed on his feet and angrily addressed the court. Slobodan Praljak is not a war criminal, he said. I am rejecting the court's ruling. The 72-year-old quickly lifted a container of liquid to his mouth and tipped his head back. The court watched, stunned and confused. Praljak's translator told the shocked hearing what he'd done.
I have taken poison.
Monsieur le Président, il vient... Not...
Okay, we suspend the... We suspend, please, the curtains. Don't take away the glass that he used when he drank something.
Slobodan Praljak was a commander of the Bosnian Croat forces. He'd been found guilty of destroying the famous Ottoman-era bridge in the city of Mostar and of persecuting Muslims. Outside the court, the ambulances arrived and fire crews wearing oxygen tanks on their backs dashed inside.
This way. Okay, here we go, please.
This was a shocking conclusion to the work of the tribunal. It was set up by the UN before the end of the war and has surpassed expectations in dealing with every one of the 161 suspects. While it has faced allegations of bias from politicians on all sides, many of the victims believe the hearings have given them some form of justice. Now, the criminal court has itself become a crime scene. And the question is, how could an institution with such tight security and such an impressive record allow such a fatal lapse?
And it was a fatal lapse. Praljak died after ingesting the liquid. It truly is an incredible story. That was the BBC's Anna Holligan reporting the chaotic scenes today at The Hague at the UN War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. I'm Marco Werman. Here's a question that's been bugging Patrick Meyer.
How do you take 100,000 mosquitoes, put it in a relatively small box, sort of a size of a shoebox, and have them not kill each other?
He thinks he's figured it out, though, as part of an effort to use drones to fight malaria and other diseases. We'll connect those dots for you, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've gotten used to seeing unusual things on the presidential Twitter feed, but this morning there was something especially surprising from @RealDonaldTrump. Three retweets from the Twitter feed of the deputy leader of a small British far-right group called Britain First. Our own Leo Hornack joins us now from London. What exactly did Trump retweet, Leo?
Well, Marco, they're a pretty strange set of videos. I've got them on my phone right now. There's one which appears to show the murder of a boy by ISIS. Another one just appears to show apparent Islamists breaking a statue of the Virgin Mary. And a third one shows what is claimed to be a Muslim teenager attacking and kicking a Dutch teenager in a park, and the Dutch teenager is on crutches. There's no context, there's no commentary given on them, but they're all posted by Jada Franson, the deputy leader of a group called Britain First, one of the most kind of media savvy of the British far right groups.
So are these scenes in these videos, first of all, are they staged or are they real?
That's impossible to know, really. I mean, particularly the one of the boy on crutches being kicked by another boy. You know, there's no real way to know if this is staged, if these are two friends messing about. Trying to actually dig into the content here is something that we, that, you know, you could spend a lot of time doing.
So real or staged, it sounds like these videos were intended to provoke. What exactly is Britain First?
Well, they claim to be a patriotic political party and street movement that fights the many injustices that are routinely inflicted on the British people. But what that means in practice is that they are anti-Islam. I mean, I'll just give you a flavor of the kind of thing that Jada Franson indulges in. This is from a clip from a BBC documentary about her and her movement when she was campaigning against halal food in British restaurants. Have a listen to how she described Islam in this.
I don't acknowledge Allah. Allah is not the same God as the Christian God. Allah, in my opinion, is Satan. And I am not prepared to eat meat that's been offered to Satan, and neither should anyone else in Britain. So that's why we're spreading awareness.
So basically, you've got the President of the United States retweeting propaganda from a far-right fringe British group. Is that correct?
That's a pretty good summary, frankly, Marco. I mean, the reaction in Britain has been what you kind of would expect. You know, there's open sort of shock and anger from a lot of mainstream political figures in the opposition. One of the most prominent Labour opposition, that's kind of left-leaning politicians, called David Lammy, a London politician, wrote, "Trump sharing Britain First, let that sink in. The president of the US is promoting a fascist, racist, extremist hate group whose leaders have been arrested and convicted. He's no ally or friend of ours." So that's what's happening amongst the sort of opposition. But I'm sure this presents a real dilemma for Prime Minister Theresa May, because Britain First is completely outside the pale of British politics. But on the other hand, it's not really politically possible for someone like Theresa May to openly criticize Donald Trump. We know that doesn't go well, generally, when people openly criticize Donald Trump. So Theresa May has had to issue a statement very sort of carefully saying that it was the wrong thing to do to retweet Britain First material.
Are Brits wondering why Trump retweeted this now?
I think people are, but I think Americans are as well. I mean, I think the really interesting question is how this tweet reached Trump in the first place, because I don't believe that Donald Trump is actually greatly knowledgeable about fringe political groups in Britain. But I think there is somehow a connection. There is a flow of information happening between fringe groups, far-right groups in places like Britain and other parts of the world and the White House. That's something we haven't seen before. And there is an aggregator. There is some kind of conduit that is connecting the president with people who are seen as far, far outside the mainstream in their own countries. And Britain First would exactly fall into that category.
Our man in London at the BBC, Leo Hornack. Thanks very much for this, Leo.
Thank you, Marco.
We take our toilets for granted here in the United States, but that's not the case for nearly 4.5 billion people around the world. They have to go out and look for an available toilet. It's not easy. And for women and girls, the search for facilities means fear. Fear of being harassed or attacked. WaterAid is an international nonprofit promoting clean water, sanitation, and hygiene, and they found that in that 4.5 billion number, there are more than 1.1 billion women and girls who can't go to the bathroom feeling safe. Chilufya Chilishe is WaterAid's regional advocacy manager for Southern Africa. Chilufya, women tend to be affected by lack of toilets more than men. Can you explain that?
Yes, we know that because of the biological needs of women, they will need to have decent toilets for far more reasons than men will. So if you think about when they're girls and have to deal with menstruation in the school to when they're young adults managing menstruation in the workplace, there usually is no facility that is safe and private and allows them the access to save water for washing their hands or washing up should they need to. But there's also a social aspect to it. There is a huge amount of burden on them and fear when it comes to open defecation, for instance. So in many communities, they don't have decent toilets and have to use the bush. And there's fear of rape and sometimes death in those instances.
Yeah, I understand exactly what you're talking about. I saw this in Nairobi, girls missing classes in school when they have their periods and the schools don't have a private toilet. It does seem like all of this could be preventable if with some basic remedies. Why does it persist?
Well, it definitely could be preventable. I would say that from what we find in our work at WaterAid is that it persists because for various reasons, but I just pick up two. The first is the problem is not visible enough. So when we think about water and sanitation and hygiene challenges, we talk a lot about the access to water and the challenges of people walking and women, especially walking long distances carrying buckets. But we often don't think about the sanitation part. What does it involve? What does it mean when a girl doesn't have a toilet in a school? So the problem is not visible enough. As a result, it gets very little financing. So financing for toilets as compared to water is very, very minuscule. So that means that a lot of the action just simply doesn't happen.
Are governments acknowledging the importance of safe sanitation? Do they see this kind of balance that needs to be struck between water and sanitation?
Well, because it's not visible enough, it often gets very slow traction. I think that there has been great buy-in on ending open defecation, and so a lot of progress is being made on that front. But when you get people away from defecating in the open, this next level of the discussion is what is the quality of the toilets they now have? Mm. And I think that that's where we need to get a lot more of discussion there. The other challenge with governments is, and governments and communities alike, I would say here, is that sanitation is often seen as a very private household responsibility. As a result, governments in most instances do not invest in building latrines for households. And many people would say, yeah, that's as it should be. If you build a house, you should definitely plan to include a toilet. But in many poor communities, we know that it simply isn't possible. And the issue is not as simple as that. So once we get to that point, I think we will see a lot more progress and action by governments. But I think that we are not there yet.
My experience in Kenya in Kibera, Nairobi, was pretty remarkable. Girls took up a collection to establish a private bathroom, and they charged a fee to use it. So they made some money, and they had their privacy because they had the key to the bathroom. Do you feel that women and girls are included in this process to make sure their needs are being met?
There are many innovative ideas, such as the one you describe in the case of Kenya. But I would tell you that from my experience, I find that there are rather few. And the main reason is women and girls just get left behind. They are not heard, and it's not often not factored into the design of even the few toilets that are built.
Let's go out on a hopeful note. Where have you seen real progress, where attitudes have changed, the plumbing was actually installed, and access to toilets was made safer for women?
Well, there are lots of actors like WaterAid that are going out and trying to set an example of how we could respond in institutions like schools and healthcare facilities, maternity wards especially, trying to show how to build a gender-friendly toilet that is the right size if a woman was pregnant. Because you'll be surprised, in some countries like Malawi, we did find they had built latrines at the healthcare facility, but they were just far too small for a pregnant woman to go through the door. So they're those sorts of things that WaterAid and others are trying to do to model a gender-friendly toilet, but also give a standard for how we should be thinking about basic sanitation for people.
Chilufya Chileshe is the Regional Advocacy Manager for Southern Africa for WaterAid. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great. Thank you very much.
Let's turn now to the deadliest animal on the planet. And I'm not talking about humans here. We are the second most deadly, by the way, as a species. We kill about 475,000 other humans per year. Want to guess who takes top spot? Mosquitoes. Yep, they carry viruses and parasites that kill 700,000 people each year. That's according to the World Health Organization. And millions more who don't die are still affected by diseases such as malaria, Zika, West Nile virus, and yellow fever. One tool being used to battle this threat is called SIT. That's short for sterile insect technique.
The more sterile male mosquitoes you release in the wild, the more competition the non-sterile mosquitoes have in terms of their reproduction, and the overall population, therefore, of the mosquitoes in an area falls, sometimes quite drastically.
That's Patrick Meyer. He's with a company called We Robotics.
The challenge with the current method of delivery of these mosquitoes is that it's been ground-based. And first of all, not everybody lives next to a road. And second of all, even if roads do exist in some of these areas, they look very different when the rainy seasons hit. You know, it'll be just a river of mud. And of course, when it rains is when you have pools of standing water and even more mosquitoes. And so what we're doing that nobody else has done is to make it such that we release these mosquitoes from the air using affordable drones.
We Robotics, which has offices in Switzerland and the U.S., has partnered with the IAEA on this project. Yes, the International Atomic Energy Agency. They use radiation to sterilize male mosquitoes. We Robotics has been developing drone technology to get those sterile insects to parts of Latin America that have been hit by Zika. Meyer told me it's a complicated job.
You're not releasing 10 mosquitoes. That's just going to have zero impact. You ultimately will want to release hundreds of thousands, if not millions of mosquitoes. Now, how do you take 100,000 mosquitoes, put it in a relatively small box, sort of a size of a shoebox, and have them not kill each other? 20, 30 mosquitoes in a small box, they'll start ripping each other to shreds. Put 100,000 mosquitoes, and it's just going to be a mess. So how do you address this challenge? Well, you have to keep the mosquitoes in a kind of sleep state, which means you reduce the temperature within this, quote, box between 4 to 10 degrees Celsius. So that's already an engineering challenge. Is how do you ensure that this temperature control is there during the flight? Then you have to release them in a way that is controlled. You're not releasing 100,000 as soon as you get to 400 feet. You're trying to do a homogeneous release over a gridded area. Remember, these mosquitoes are basically knocked out, if you'd like, or tranquilized. How do you ensure that as they're falling from the release mechanism, they actually wake up in time before they go splat on the ground, right? So there are all these parameters in terms of the release mechanism, is in terms of the flight parameters, optimal speed, optimal altitude, the angle of release, and so on.
As you said, Patrick, this technique, the sterile insect technique, it's been used for a long time, except people have been doing the delivery on the ground. Are you confident that the drone delivery will be more effective?
So what we're looking to do with the leading experts in this space is complement the field-based, the ground-based release. We're not suggesting that there's a silver bullet here. And quite on the contrary, what we want to be able to do is have multiple tools in the toolbox. Now, of course, in those locations where you have no roads, having aerial release versus doing nothing will actually be more effective. There's no doubt about that.
What are the environmental implications of reducing mosquito populations in this manner?
What we've been told is that the mosquitoes themselves don't actually represent an important food group in the food ecosystem where we'd be working. And you always have to look at compared to what? Compared to distributing pesticides and so forth. The arguments that I've heard from scientists is that one of the reasons they're interested in the sterile insect technique is in part because of the reduced environmental implications.
Patrick, let me just ask you this. Indulge me if you would. I've got to just ask the Godzilla question because we're talking irradiated mosquitoes. Is it possible any of these individuals might not become sterile but become like some freak mosquito?
So that's the technique that the IAEA team has really refined, that basically they have tests in order to ensure that any of the mosquitoes that they then release are indeed sterilized. So it's a quality control question, a set of processes that they've put in place specifically because what you're just describing is something that nobody wants.
Your project proposes sending these drones into communities and they'll release hundreds of thousands, millions of mosquitoes. What are those people going to think? I mean, it could be really alarming. Will there be an education component so people will know what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. And then keep in mind that our first efforts will be to complement the ground-based release. And so what has happened already prior to the ground-based release of mosquitoes is community engagement, is outreach So that work has already happened around ground-based release.
Patrick Meyer, he is the co-founder of We Robotics. Thanks very much for telling us about this drone project.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's not uncommon for people to travel through Israeli checkpoints for medical procedures. Mostly that means people heading into Israel to get treatment. But some Arab Israeli women who live in Israel are traveling in the opposite direction, and they're doing it so they can choose the sex of their babies. Shana Sheely has a story of one Arab Israeli woman who crossed the border into the West Bank hoping for a baby boy.
Fatin lives in a big house perched on a hill in the Arab-Israeli city of Umm al-Fahim. She has three young daughters, today all dressed in matching black pants and lacy maroon tops. Her youngest, who's 4 years old, sings and scoots around the kitchen in a toy car. Fatin is 30, and she's pregnant. Again. Early in her third pregnancy, Fatin went to her doctor for an ultrasound. She arrived with a caravan of family members and boxes of sweets to celebrate. Her husband stood by her when the doctor pulled up the sonogram.
And he said, "You have a third queen coming." I saw the big smile on my husband's face.
He was thrilled for another girl.
He was happy, but I won't deny that I was not. I started crying.
She says the next few months were the most difficult of her life. Even though the pregnancy was a healthy one, people in her community treated her as if she'd experienced a loss.
I decided during the pregnancy that I would not go through this again.
Fatin decided to make sure her next baby would be a boy. She traveled to the West Bank to go to a state-of-the-art fertility clinic in Nablus. The doctors there use a technique called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. It's often used for early diagnosis of genetic mutations, but it can also be used to determine the sex of a fertilized egg before it's implanted via in vitro fertilization. Fatin says she went through three IVF attempts before she got pregnant this way.
Definitely, it's worth it. I need that boy.
Fatin has never heard anyone talk publicly about sex selection, and she's not sure how people in her community would react to her story. So she asked me to use a pseudonym. As an Israeli citizen, Fatin is covered by universal healthcare, which includes fertility treatments. Israel has one of the highest rates of IVF in the world, but IVF for sex selection is highly regulated there, influenced by Jewish religious authorities. Couples are only eligible if they've had four children of the same gender. In the West Bank, sex selection is largely unregulated, and about 20% of the women seeking sex selection at the Nablus clinic are Arab Israeli citizens, like Fatin. Her doctor, Omar Abduldayem, says it makes for happier families. Having only daughters can cause tension. Husbands might divorce their wives.
Because they want a son.
Back in Umm al-Fahim, Fatin's husband wraps his arms around his girls on a big leather couch. He says it's his wife who wants a son. Fatin gets impatient with that. She has degrees in math and computer science and has a full-time job.
A wife and mother is no longer someone who stays at home and keeps having children. I have a career, and I also have to take care of my girls.
Fatin says she feels a lot of pressure to have a boy to carry on the family name.
When you meet a woman with three sons, you feel like she's on top of the world.
While we talk, Fatin's daughters are on the couch, watching her, listening. I ask how she thinks hearing this conversation makes the girls feel.
These girls are constantly hearing people wishing me to have a son. So they're aware of the social pressures.
She wants her girls to know they are loved. Fatin has big dreams for her girls. Outside of school, they ride horses, play sports, and study music. Everyone knows girls are higher achievers than boys, she says. And Fatin sees herself as one of those high-achieving women.
I live in a family that really appreciates me for who I am. And so it's hard for me that this baby could somehow determine whether I'm a successful woman.
I visited Fatin and her family a few months back, and when I called her earlier this month, she told me she gave birth to her fourth child. It's a boy. For The World, Shaina Shealy, Umm Al Fahim, Israel.
When it comes to strictly defined gender roles, violinist Jyotsna Srikanth can relate, I'm sure. She's been bucking the system and male prejudice ever since she was a young girl growing up in South India. More on that in a moment. First, her music. After learning to play Indian classical music, Jyotsna Srikanth decided she wanted to play something more contemporary and more Western, so she started composing it herself. Despite her success, though, Srikanth says being a female violinist in India has not been easy for her.
Gender was a major issue, actually. Even now in South India, many of the male musicians would say that if there is a female on stage, we are not going to go on the stage and perform with her. This used to happen when I used to accompany the vocalist on stage. There was a very famous, very popular South Indian classical vocalist. I was supposed to play with him. But then the percussionist said that she's good, all respects, but I'm not going on the stage if there is a female. I had to walk off. It was such a humiliation. And I was only 16 years old. I cried, but who cared? No one.
But now the tables have turned, sort of. If Jyotsna Srikanth wasn't going to get the respect from male colleagues in India, then she'd have to go elsewhere, like London, where she's now an established musician. And yeah, the men who once refused to play with her in India now seek her out when they head to the UK.
Recently, there was some big musician came to London and who had refused my accompaniment in India. And there, I was supposed to play with him a few years back. He said, no, all my respects, because she's a female, she's not playing with me. Whereas in London, he wanted me to accompany him. I asked him a question, do I become a male in London and a female in India? So I refused to accompany him. Now it's the other way around.
Sometimes justice is slow, but it comes around eventually. We close the show today with the music of Indian violinist and composer Jyotsna Srikanth from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.